it, and hearing my parents' names come out of this wizard's mouth was disquieting. I swallowed hard. "Please clear your friends out of the library. The new students arrived today, and we wouldn't want to frighten them."
"If we could have a quiet word, Dr. Bishop, I'm sure we could come to some arrangement."
He pushed his glasses up over the bridge of his nose. The closer I was to Knox, the more danger I felt. The skin under my fingernails started to prickle ominously.
"You have nothing to fear from me," he said sorrowfully.
"That vampire, on the other hand..."
"You think I found something that belongs to the witches," I interrupted. "I no longer have it. If you want Ashmole 782, there are request slips on the desk in front of you."
"You don't understand the complexity of the situation."
"No, and I don't want to. Please leave me alone."
"Physically, you are very like your mother." Knox's eyes swept over my face. "But you have some of Stephen's stubbornness as well, I see." I felt the usual combination of envy and irritation that accompanied a witch's references to my parents or family history, as if they had an equal claim to mine.
"I'll try," he continued, "but I don't control those animals."
He waved across the aisle, where one of the scary sisters was watching Knox and me with interest. I hesitated and crossed over to her seat.
"I'm sure you heard our conversation, and you must know I'm under the direct supervision of two vampires already," I said. "You're welcome to stay, if you don't trust Matthew and Miriam, but clear the others out of the upper reading room."
"Witches are hardly ever worth a moment of a vampire's time, but you are full of surprises today, Diana Bishop. Wait until I tell my sister Clarissa what she's missed."
The female vampire's words came out in a lush, unhurried drawl, redolent of impeccable breeding and a fine education. She smiled, teeth gleaming in the low light of the medieval wing.
"Challenging Knox, a child like you. What a tale I'll have to tell."
I dragged my eyes away from her flawless features and went off in search of a familiar demonic face. The latte-loving demon was drifting around the computer terminals, wearing headphones and humming under his breath to some unheard music as the end of the cord was swinging freely around the tops of his thighs. Once he pulled the white plastic discs from his ears, I tried to impress upon him the seriousness of the situation.
"Look, you're welcome to keep surfing the net up here, but we've got a problem downstairs. It's not necessary for 24 demons to be watching me."
The demon made an indulgent sound.
"You'll know soon enough."
"Could they watch me from farther away? The Sheldonian? The White Horse?" I was trying to be helpful.
"If not, the human readers will start asking questions."
"We're not like you," he said dreamily.
"Does that mean you can't help, or you won't?"
I tried not to sound impatient.
"It's all the same thing. We need to know, too."
This was impossible. "Whatever you can do to take some of the pressure off the seats would be greatly appreciated." Miriam was still watching me. Ignoring her, I returned to my desk. At the end of the completely unproductive day, I pinched the bridge of my nose, swore under my breath, and packed up my things. The next morning, the Bodleian was far less crowded. Miriam was scribbling furiously and didn't look up when I passed. There was still no sign of Claremont. Even so, everybody was observing the rules that he had clearly, if silently, laid down, and they stayed out of the Selden End. Gillian was in the medieval wing, crouched over her papyri, as were both scary sisters and a few demons. With the exception of Gillian, who was doing real work, the rest went through the motions with perfect respectability. And when I stuck my head around the swinging door into the upper reading room after a hot cup of tea at mid-morning, only a few creatures looked up. The musical, coffee-loving demon was among them. He tipped his fingers and winked at me knowingly. I got a reasonable amount of work done, although not enough to make up for yesterday. I began by reading alchemical poems, the trickiest of texts, that were attributed to Mary, the sister of Moses. "Three things, if you 3 hours attend," read one part of the poem, "are chained together in the end." The meaning of the verses remained a mystery, although the most likely subject was the chemical combination of silver, gold, and mercury. Could Chris produce an experiment from this poem? I wondered, noting the possible chemical processes involved. When I turned to another anonymous poem entitled Verse on the Threefold Sapphic Fire, the similarities between its imagery and an illumination I'd seen yesterday of an alchemical mountain, riddled with mines and miners digging in the ground for precious metals and stones, were unmistakable. Within this mine, two stones of old were found, whence this the ancients called holy ground, who knew their value, power, and extent, and nature how with nature to ferment. For these, if you ferment with natural gold or silver, their hid treasures they unfold. I stifled a groan. My research would become exponentially more complicated if I had to connect not only art and science, but art and poetry. It must be hard to concentrate on your research with vampires watching you. Gillian Chamberlain was standing next to me, her hazel eyes sparkling with suppressed malevolence. What do you want, Gillian?
I'm just being friendly, Diana. We're sisters, remember?
Gillian's shiny black hair swung above her collar. Its smoothness suggested that she was not troubled by surges of static electricity. Her power must be regularly released. I shivered. I have no sisters, Gillian. I'm an only child. It's a good thing, too. Your family has caused more than enough trouble. Look at what happened at Salem. It was all Bridget Bishop's fault. Gillian's tone was vicious. Here we go again, I thought, closing the volume before me. As usual, the bishops were proving to be an irresistible topic of conversation. What are you talking about, Gillian? My voice was sharp. Bridget Bishop was found guilty of witchcraft and executed. She didn't instigate the witch hunt. She was a victim of it, just like the others. You know that, as does every other witch in this library. Bridget Bishop drew human attention, first with those puppets of hers, and then with her provocative clothes and immorality. The human hysteria would have passed if not for her. She was found innocent of practicing witchcraft, I retorted, bristling.
In 1680, but no one believed it. Not after they found the puppets in her cellar wall, pins stuck through them and their heads ripped off. Afterward, Bridget did nothing to protect her fellow witches from falling under suspicion. She was so independent.
Gillian's voice dropped. That was your mother's fatal flaw, too. Stop it, Gillian. The air around us seemed unnaturally cold and clear.
Your mother and father were standoffish just like you, thinking they didn't need the Cambridge Coven support after they got married. They learned, didn't they?
I shut my eyes, but it was impossible to block out the image I'd spent most of my life trying to forget. My mother and father lying dead in the middle of a chalk-marked circle somewhere in Nigeria, their bodies broken and bloody. My aunt wouldn't share the details of their death at the time, so I'd slipped into the public library to look them up. That's where I'd first seen the picture and the lurid headline that accompanied it. The nightmares had gone on for years afterward. There was nothing the Cambridge Coven could do to prevent my parents' murder. They were killed on another continent by fearful humans. I gripped the arms of my chair, hoping that she wouldn't see my white knuckles. Gillian gave an unpleasant laugh.
It wasn't humans, Diana. If it had been, their killers would have been caught and dealt with.
She crouched down, her face close to mine. Rebecca Bishop and Stephen Proctor were keeping secrets from other witches. We needed to discover them. Their deaths were unfortunate, but necessary. Your father had more power than we ever dreamed. Stop talking about my family and my parents as though they belong to you, I warned. They were killed by humans. There was a roaring in my ears, and the coldness that surrounded us was intensifying.
Are you sure?
Gillian whispered, sending a fresh chill into my bones. As a witch, you'd know if I was lying to you. I governed my features, determined not to show my confusion. What Gillian said about my parents couldn't be true, and yet there were none of the subtle alarms that typically accompanied untruths between witches. the spark of anger, an overwhelming feeling of contempt. Think about what happened to Bridget Bishop and your parents the next time you turned down an invitation to a coven gathering, Jillian murmured, her lips so close to my ear that her breath swept against my skin. A witch shouldn't keep secrets from other witches. Bad things happen when she does. Jillian straightened and stared at me for a few seconds, the tingle of her glance growing uncomfortable the longer it lasted. Staring fixedly at the closed manuscript before me, I refused to meet her eyes. After she left, the air's temperature returned to normal. When my heart stopped pounding and the roaring in my ears abated, I packed my belongings with shaking hands, badly wanting to be back in my rooms. Adrenaline was coursing through my body, and I wasn't sure how long it would be possible to fend off my panic. I managed to get out of the library without incident, avoiding Miriam's sharp glance. If Jillian was right, it was the jealousy of fellow witches that I needed to be wary of, not human fear. And the mention of my father's hidden powers made something half-remembered flit at the edges of my mind, but it eluded me when I tried to fix it in place long enough to see it clearly. At New College, Fred hailed me from the porter's lodge with a fistful of mail. A creamy envelope, thick with a distinctive woven feeling, lay on top. It was a note from the warden, summoning me for a drink before dinner. In my rooms, I considered calling his secretary and feigning illness to get out of the invitation. My head was reeling, and there was little chance I could keep down even a drop of sherry in my present state. But the college had behaved handsomely when I'd requested a place to stay. The least I could do was express my thanks personally. My sense of professional obligation began to supplant the anxiety stirred up by Jillian. Holding on to my identity as a scholar like a lifeline, I resolved to make my appreciation known. After changing, I made my way to the warden's lodgings and rang the bell. A member of the college staff opened the door and ushered me inside, leading me to the parlor. "Hello, Dr. Bishop!" Nicholas Marsh's blue eyes crinkled at the corners, and his snowy white hair and round red cheeks made him look like Santa Claus. Soothed by his warmth and armored with a sense of professional duty, I smiled. "Professor Marsh," I took his outstretched hand. "Thank you for inviting me."
"It's overdue, I'm afraid. I was in Italy, you know."
"Yes, the bursar told me."
"Then you have forgiven me for neglecting you for so long," he said. "I hope to make it up to you by introducing you to an old friend of mine who is in Oxford for a few days. He's a well-known author and writes about subjects that might interest you."
Marsh stood aside, giving me a glimpse of a thick head of brown hair peppered with gray and the sleeve of a brown tweed jacket. I froze in confusion.
"Come and meet Peter Knox," the warden said, taking my elbow gently. "He's acquainted with your work."
The wizard stood. Finally, I recognized what had been eluding me. Knox's name had been in the newspaper story about vampire murders. He was the expert the police called in to examine deaths that had an occult twist. My fingers started to itch.
"Dr. Bishop," Knox said, holding out his hand, "I've seen you in the Bodleian."
"Yes, I believe you have." I extended my own and was relieved to see that it was not emitting sparks. We clasped hands as briefly as possible. His right fingertips flickered slightly, a tiny furl and a release of bones and skin that no human would have noticed. It reminded me of my childhood, when my mother's hands had flickered and furled to produce pancakes and fold laundry. Shutting my eyes, I braced for an outpouring of magic. The phone rang.
"I must get that, I'm afraid," Marsh apologized. "Do sit down."
I sat as far from Knox as possible, perched on a straight-backed wooden chair usually reserved for disgraced junior members of the college. Knox and I remained silent while Marsh murmured and tutted into the phone. He punched a button on the console and approached me, a glass of sherry in his hand.
"That's the Vice-Chancellor. 2 freshers have gone missing," he said, using the university's slang term for new students. "You 2 chat while I deal with this in my study. Please excuse me."
Distant doors opened and closed, and muffled voices conferred in the hall before there was silence.
"Missing students?" I said blandly. Surely Knox had magically engineered both the crisis and the phone call that had drawn Marsh away.
"I don't understand, Dr. Bishop," Knox murmured. "It seems unfortunate for the university to misplace two children. Besides, this gives us a chance to talk privately."
"What do we have to talk about?"
I sniffed my sherry and prayed for the warden's return.
"A great many things."
I glanced at the door.
"Nicholas will be quite busy until we're through."
"Let's get this over with, then, so that the warden can return to his drink."
"As you wish," Knox said.
"Tell me what brought you to Oxford, Dr. Bishop."
"Alchemy." I would answer the man's questions if only to get Marsh back into the room, but wasn't going to tell him more than was necessary.
"You must have known that Ashmole 782 was bewitched. No one with even a drop of Bishop blood in her veins could have failed to notice. Why did you send it back?"
Knox's brown eyes were sharp. He wanted the manuscript as much as Matthew Claremont did, if not more.
"I was done with it."
It was difficult to keep my voice even.
"Was there nothing about the manuscript that piqued your interest?"
"Nothing."
Peter Knox's mouth twisted into an ugly expression. He knew I was lying.
"Have you shared your observations with the vampire?"
"I take it you mean Professor Claremont."
When creatures refused to use proper names, it was a way of denying that those who are not like you were your equals.
Knox's fingers unwound once more. When I thought he might point them at me, he curled them around the arms of his chair instead.
"We all respect your family and what you've endured. Nevertheless, questions have been raised about your unorthodox relationship with this creature. You are betraying your ancestral lineage with this self-indulgent behavior. It must stop."
"Professor Claremont is a professional colleague," I said, steering the conversation away from my family. "And I know nothing about the manuscript. It was in my possession for a matter of minutes. Yes, I knew it was under a spell, but that was immaterial to me, since I'd requested it to study the contents."
"The vampire has wanted that book for more than a century," Knox said, his voice vicious. "He mustn't be allowed to have it."
"Why?" My voice crackled with suppressed anger. "Because it belongs to the witches? Vampires and demons can't enchant objects. A witch put that book under a spell, and now it's back under the same spell. What are you worried about?"
"More than you could possibly comprehend, Dr. Bishop."
"I'm confident I can keep up, Mr. Knox," I replied. Knox's mouth tightened with displeasure when I emphasized his position outside the academy. Every time the wizard used my title, his formality sounded like a taunt, as if he were trying to make a point that he, not I, was the real expert. I might not use my power, and I couldn't have conjured up my own lost keys, but being patronized by this wizard was intolerable.
"I am disturbed that you, a bishop, are associating with a vampire."
He held up his hand as a protest bubbled to my lips.
"Let's not insult each other with further untruths. Instead of the natural revulsion you should feel for that animal, you feel gratitude."
I remained silent, seething.
"And I'm concerned because we are perilously close to catching human attention," he continued.
"I tried to get the creatures out of the library."
"Ah, but it's not just the library, is it? A vampire is leaving drained, bloodless corpses around Westminster. The demons are unusually restless, vulnerable as ever to their own madness and the swings of energy in the world. We can't afford to be noticed."
"You told the reporters that there was nothing supernatural about those deaths."
Knox looked incredulous.
"You don't expect me to tell humans everything."
"I do, actually, when they're paying you."
"You're not only self-indulgent, you're foolish. That surprises me, Dr. Bishop. Your father was known for his good sense."
"I've had a long day. Is that all?"
Standing abruptly, I moved toward the door. Even in normal circumstances, it was difficult to listen to anyone but Sarah and Em talking about my parents. Now, after Jillian's revelations, there was something almost obscene about it.
No, it is not, said Knox unpleasantly. What I am most intrigued by at present is the question of how an ignorant witch with no training of any sort managed to break a spell that has defied the efforts of those far more adept than you will ever be. So that's why you're all watching me.
I sat down, my back pressing against the chair's slats.
Don't look so pleased with yourself, he said curtly. Your success may have been a fluke.
An anniversary reaction related to when the spell was first cast. The passage of time can interfere with witchcraft, and anniversaries are particularly volatile moments. You haven't tried to recall it yet, but when you do, it may not come as easily as it did the first time.
And what anniversary would we be celebrating?
The sesquicentennial.
I had wondered why a witch would put a spell on the manuscript in the first place. Someone must have been looking for it all those years ago, too. I blanched. We were back to Matthew Claremont and his interest in Ashmole 782.
You are managing to keep up, aren't you?
The next time you see your vampire, ask him what he was doing in the autumn of 1859. I doubt he'll tell you the truth, but he might reveal enough for you to figure it out on your own.
I'm tired. Why don't you tell me, witch to witch, what your interest is in Ashmole 782?
I'd heard why the demons wanted the manuscript. Even Matthew had given me some explanation. Knox's fascination with it was a missing piece of the puzzle.
That manuscript belongs to us, Knox said fiercely. We're the only creatures who can understand its secrets, and the only creatures who can be trusted to keep them.
What is in the manuscript? I said, temper flaring at last.
The first spells ever constructed. Descriptions of the enchantments that bind the world together.
Knox's face grew dreamy.
The secret of immortality, how witches made the first demon. How vampires can be destroyed once and for all.
His eyes pierced mine. It's the source of all our power, past and present. It cannot be allowed to fall into the hands of demons or vampires, or humans. The events of the afternoon were catching up with me, and I had to press my knees together to keep them from shaking.
Nobody would put all that information in a single book. The first witch did, Knox said, and her sons and daughters, too, down through time. It's our history, Diana. Surely you want to protect it from prying eyes.
The warden entered the room as if he'd been waiting by the door. The tension was suffocating, but he seemed blissfully unaware of it.
What a palaver over nothing!
Marsh shook his white head.
The Freshers illegally obtained a punt. They were located, stuck under a bridge and a little worse for wine, utterly content with their situation. A romance may result.
I'm so glad, I murmured. The clocks struck 45 minutes past the hour, and I stood.
Is that the time? I have a dinner engagement.
You won't be joining us for dinner? The warden asked with a frown. Peter has been looking forward to talking to you about alchemy.
Our paths will cross again.
Soon, Knox said smoothly. My visit was such a surprise, and, of course, the lady has better things to do than have dinner with two men of our age.
Be careful with Matthew Claremont.
Knox's voice rang in my head. He's a killer.
Marsh smiled.
Yes, of course. I do hope to see you again when the Freshers have settled down.
Ask him about 1859. See if he'll share his secrets with a witch.
It's hardly a secret if you know it.
Surprise registered on Knox's face when I replied to his mental warning in kind. It was the sixth time I'd used magic this year, but these were surely extenuating circumstances.
It would be a pleasure, Warden, and thank you again for letting me stay in college this year.
I nodded to the wizard.
Mr. Knox.
Fleeing from the warden's lodgings, I turned toward my old refuge in the cloisters and walked among the pillars until my pulse stopped racing. My mind was occupied with only one question: what to do now that two witches, my own people, had threatened me in the space of a single afternoon? With sudden clarity, I knew the answer.
In my rooms, I searched my bag until my fingers found Claremont's crumpled business card, and then I dialed the first number. He didn't answer. After a robotic voice indicated that it was ready to receive my message, I spoke.
Matthew, it's Diana. I'm sorry to bother you when you're out of town.
I took a deep breath, trying to dispel some of the guilt associated with my decision not to tell Claremont about Jillian and my parents, but only about Knox.
We need to talk. Something has happened. It's that wizard from the library. His name is Peter Knox. If you get this message, please call me.
I'd assured Sarah and Em that no vampire would meddle in my life. Jillian Chamberlain and Peter Knox had changed my mind. With shaking hands, I lowered the shades and locked the door, wishing I'd never heard of Ashmole 782. Chapter 11. That night, sleep was impossible. I sat on the sofa, then on the bed, the phone at my side. Not even a pot of tea and a raft of email took my mind off the day's events. The notion that witches might have murdered my parents was beyond my comprehension. Pushing back those thoughts, I instead puzzled over the spell on Ashmole 782 and Knox's interest in it. Still awake at dawn, I showered and changed. The idea of breakfast was uncharacteristically unappetizing. Rather than eat, I perched by the door until the Bodleian opened, then walked the short distance to the library and took my regular seat. My phone was in my pocket, set to vibrate, even though I hated it when other people's phones started buzzing and hopping in the quiet. At 10:30, Peter Knox strolled in and sat at the opposite end of the room. On the premise of returning a manuscript, I walked back to the call desk to make sure that Miriam was still in the library. She was, and she was angry.
"Tell me that witch didn't take a seat down there."
"He did. He keeps staring at my back while I work."
"I wish I were larger," Miriam said with a frown.
Somehow I think it would take more than size to deter that creature. I gave her a lopsided smile. When Matthew came into the Selden End, without warning or sound, no icy patches announced his arrival. Instead, there were touches of snowflakes all along my hair, shoulders, and back, as if he were checking quickly to make sure I was all in one piece. My fingers gripped the table in front of me. For a few moments, I didn't dare turn in case it was simply Miriam. When I saw it was indeed Matthew, my heart gave a single loud thump. But the vampire was no longer looking in my direction. He was staring at Peter Knox, his face ferocious.
"Matthew," I called softly, rising to my feet.
He dragged his eyes from the witch and strode to my side. When I frowned uncertainly at his fierce expression, he gave me a reassuring smile.
"I understand there's been some excitement."
He was so close that the coolness of his body felt as refreshing as a breeze on a summer day.
"Nothing we couldn't handle," I said evenly, conscious of Peter Knox.
"Can our conversation wait just until the end of the day?" he asked.
Matthew's fingers strayed up to touch a bump on his sternum that was visible under the soft fibers of his sweater. I wondered what he was wearing close to his heart.
"We could go to yoga."
Though I'd had no sleep, a drive to Woodstock in a moving vehicle with very good sound insulation, followed by an hour and a half of meditative movement, sounded perfect.
"That would be wonderful," I said sincerely.
"Would you like me to work here with you?"
he asked, leaning toward me. His scent was so powerful it was dizzying.
"That's not necessary," I said firmly.
"Let me know if you change your mind. Otherwise, I'll see you outside Hartford at 6.
Matthew held my eyes a few moments longer. Then he sent a look of loathing in Peter Knox's direction and returned to his seat. When I passed his desk on the way to lunch, Matthew coughed. Miriam slammed her pencil down in irritation and joined me. Knox would not be following me to Blackwell's. Matthew would see to that. The afternoon dragged on interminably, and it was almost impossible to stay awake.
By 5 o'clock, I was more than ready to leave the library. Knox remained in the Selden End, along with a motley assortment of humans. Matthew walked me downstairs, and my spirits lightened as I raced back to college, changed, and picked up my yoga mat. When his car pulled up to Hartford's metal railings, I was waiting for him.
"You're early,"
he observed with a smile, taking my mat and putting it into the trunk. Matthew breathed in sharply as he helped me into the car, and I wondered what messages my body had passed on to him.
"We need to talk."
"There's no rush. Let's get out of Oxford first." He closed the car door behind me and climbed into the driver's seat. The traffic on the Woodstock Road was heavier due to the influx of students and dons. Matthew maneuvered deftly around the slow spots.
"How is Scotland?" I asked as we cleared the city limits, not caring what he talked about, so long as he talked.
Matthew glanced at me and returned his eyes to the road.
"Fine."
"Miriam said you were hunting." He exhaled softly, his fingers rising to the bump under his sweater.
"She shouldn't have."
"Why?"
"Because something shouldn't be discussed in mixed company," he said with a touch of impatience. "Do witches tell creatures who aren't witches that they've just returned from 4 days of casting spells and boiling bats?"
"Witches don't boil bats," I said indignantly. "The point remains."
"Were you alone?" I asked.
Matthew waited a long time before answering.
"No."
"I wasn't alone in Oxford either," I began. "The creatures," Miriam told me. His hands tightened on the wheel.
"If I'd known that the witch bothering you was Peter Knox, I'd never have left Oxford."
"You were right," I blurted, needing to make my own confession before tackling the subject of Knox. "I never kept the magic out of my life. I've been using it in my work without realizing it. It's in everything. I've been fooling myself for years."
The words tumbled from my mouth.
Matthew remained focused on the traffic.
"I'm frightened."
His cold hand touched my knee.
"I know."
"What am I going to do?" I whispered.
"We'll figure it out," he said calmly, turning into the old lodge's gates.
He scrutinized my face as we crested the rise and pulled into the circular drive.
"You're tired. Can you manage yoga?"
I nodded. Matthew got out of the car and opened the door for me. This time, he didn't help me out. Instead, he fished around in the trunk, pulled out our mats, and shouldered both of them himself. Other members of the class filtered by, casting curious looks in our direction. He waited until we were the only ones on the drive. Matthew looked down at me, wrestling with himself over something. I frowned, my head tilted back to meet his eyes. I'd just confessed to engaging in magic without realizing it. What was so awful that he couldn't tell me?
"I was in Scotland with an old friend, Hamish Osborne," he finally said.
"The man the newspapers want to run for Parliament so he can be Chancellor of the Exchequer?" I said in amazement.
"Hamish will not be running for Parliament," Matthew said dryly, adjusting the strap of his yoga bag with a twitch.
"So he is gay," I said, thinking back to a recent late-night news program. Matthew gave me a withering glance.
"Yes. More important, he's a demon." I didn't know much about the world of creatures, but participating in human politics or religion was also forbidden.
"Oh. Finance is an odd career choice for a demon," I thought for a moment. "It explains why he's so good at figuring out what to do with all that money, though."
"He is good at figuring things out."
The silence stretched on, and Matthew made no move for the door.
"I needed to get away and hunt."
I gave him a confused look.
"You left your sweater in my car," he said, as if that were an explanation.
"Miriam gave it back to me already."
"I know. I couldn't hold on to it. Do you understand why?"
When I shook my head, he sighed and then swore in French.
"My car was full of your scent, Diana. I needed to leave Oxford."
"I still don't understand," I admitted.
"I couldn't stop thinking about you."
He raked his hand through his hair and looked down the drive. My heart was beating irregularly, and the reduced blood flow slowed my mental process. Finally, though, I understood.
You're not afraid you would hurt me?
I had a healthy fear of vampires, but Matthew seemed different.
I can't be sure.
His eyes were wary, and his voice held a warning. So you didn't go because of what happened Friday night? My breath released in sudden relief.
No, he said gently. It had nothing to do with that.
Are you two coming in, or are you going to practice out here on the drive? Amira called from the doorway.
We went into class, occasionally glancing at each other when one of us thought the other wasn't looking. Our first, honest exchange of information had altered things. We were both trying to figure out what was going to happen next. After class ended, when Matthew swung his sweater over his head, something shining in silver caught my eye. The object was tied around his neck on a thin leather cord. It was what he kept touching through his sweater, over and over, like a talisman.
What's that?
I pointed.
A reminder, Matthew said shortly.
Of what?
The destructive power of anger.
Peter Knox had warned me to be careful around Matthew.
Is it a pilgrim's badge?
The shape reminded me of one in the British Museum. It looked ancient. He nodded and pulled the badge out by the cord. It swung freely, glinting as the light struck it.
It's an Ampulla from Bethany.
It was shaped like a coffin, and just big enough to hold a few drops of holy water.
Lazarus, I said faintly, eyeing the coffin.
Bethany was where Christ had resurrected Lazarus from the dead. And though raised a pagan, I knew why Christians went on pilgrimage. They did it to atone for their sins. Matthew slid the Ampulla back into his sweater, concealing it from the eyes of the creature who were still filing out of the room. We said goodbye to Amira and stood outside the old lodge in the crisp autumn air. It was dark, despite the floodlights that bathed the bricks of the house.
Do you feel better? Matthew asked, breaking into my thoughts.
I nodded.
Then tell me what's happened.
It's the manuscript.
Knox wants it. Agatha Wilson, the creature I met in Blackwell's, said the demons want it. You want it, too. But Ashmole 782 is under a spell.
I know, he said again.
A white owl swooped down in front of us, its wings beating the air. I flinched and lifted my arms to protect myself, convinced it was going to strike me with its beak and talons. But then the owl lost interest and soared up into the oak trees along the drive. My heart was pounding, and a sudden rush of panic swept up from my feet. Without any warning, Matthew pulled open the back door of the Jaguar and pushed me into the seat.
"Keep your head down and breathe," he said, crouching on the gravel with his fingers resting on my knees. The bile rose. There was nothing in my stomach but water, and crawled up my throat, choking me. I covered my mouth with my hand and retched convulsively. He reached over and tucked a wayward piece of hair behind my ear, his fingers cool and soothing.
"You're safe," he said.
"I'm so sorry."
My shaking hand passed across my mouth as the nausea subsided. "The panic started last night after I saw Knox."
"Do you want to walk a bit?"
"No," I said hastily.
The park seemed overly large and very black, and my legs felt like they were made of rubber bands. Matthew inspected me with his keen eyes.
"I'm taking you home. The rest of this conversation can wait."
He pulled me up from the back seat and held my hand loosely until he had me settled in the front of the car. I closed my eyes while he climbed in. We sat for a moment in silence, and then Matthew turned the key in the ignition. The Jaguar quickly sprang to life.
"Does this happen often?" he asked, his voice neutral.
"No, thank God," I said. "It happened a lot when I was a child, but it's much better now. It's just an excess of adrenaline."
Matthew's glance settled on my hands as I pushed my hair from my face.
"I know," he said yet again, disengaging the parking brake and pulling out onto the drive.
"Can you smell it?"
He nodded. It's been building up in you since you told me you were using magic. Is this why you exercise so much? The running, the rowing, the yoga?
I don't like taking drugs. They make me feel fuzzy.
The exercise is probably more effective anyway.
It hasn't done the trick this time, I murmured, thinking of my recently electrified hands.
Matthew pulled out of the old lodge's grounds and onto the road. He concentrated on his driving while the car's smooth movements rocked me gently.
"Why did you call me?" Matthew asked abruptly, interrupting my reveries.
"Because of Knox and Ashmole 782, I said, flickers of panic returning at his sudden shift in mood.
"I know that. What I'm asking is why you called me. Surely you have friends, witches, humans, who could help you."
"Not really. None of my human friends know I'm a witch. It would take days just to explain what's really happening in this world, if they stuck around long enough for me to finish, that is. I don't have friends who are witches, and I can't drag my aunts into this. It's not their fault I did something stupid and sent the manuscript back when I didn't understand it."
I bit my lip.
"Should I not have called you?"
"I don't know, Diana. On Friday you said witches and vampires couldn't be friends."
"On Friday I told you a lot of things."
Matthew was quiet, giving his full attention to the curves in the road.
"I don't know what to think anymore." I paused, considering my next words carefully. "But there is one thing I know for sure. I'd rather share the library with you than with Knox."
"Vampires are never completely trustworthy. Not when they're around warm bloods."
Matthew's eyes focused on me for a single, cold moment.
"Warm bloods?" I asked with a frown.
"Humans, witches, demons, everyone who's not a vampire."
"I'll risk your bite before I let Knox slither into my brain to fish for information."
"Has he tried to do that?"
Matthew's voice was quiet, but there was a promise of violence in it.
"It was nothing," I said hastily. "He was just warning me about you." "So he should. Nobody can be what he's not, no matter how hard he tries. You mustn't romanticize vampires. Knox may not have your best interests at heart, but he was right about me."
"Other people don't pick my friends, certainly not bigots like Knox."
My fingers began to prickle as my anger mounted, and I shoved them under my thighs.
"Is that what we are, then? Friends?" Matthew asked.
"I think so. Friends tell each other the truth, even when it's difficult."
Disconcerted by the seriousness of the conversation, I toyed with the ties on my sweater.
"Vampires aren't particularly good at friendship."
He sounded angry again.
"Look, if you want me to leave you alone..."
"Of course not," Matthew interrupted. "It's just that vampire relationships are complicated. We can be protective, possessive even. You might not like it."
"A little protectiveness sounds pretty good to me about now." My answer brought a look of raw vulnerability to Matthew's eyes.
"I'll remind you of that when you start complaining," he said, the rawness quickly replaced with wry amusement.
He pulled off Hollywell Street into the arched gates of the lodge.
Fred glanced at the car and grinned before looking discreetly away. I waited for Matthew to open the door, checking the car carefully to make sure that nothing of mine was left there, not even a hair elastic, so as not to drive him back to Scotland.
"But there's more to all this than Knox and the manuscript," I said urgently when he handed me the mat. "From his behavior, you would think there weren't creatures closing in on me from every direction."
"It can wait, Diana. And don't worry, Pete and Knox won't get within 50 feet of you again."
His voice was grim, and he touched the ampulla under his sweater. "We needed time together. Not in the library, but alone."
"Would you like to come to dinner tomorrow?" I asked him, my voice low. "We could talk about what happened then."
Matthew froze, confusion flitting over his face, along with something I couldn't name. His fingers flexed slightly around the pilgrim's badge before he released it.
"I'd like that," he said slowly.
"Good." I smiled. "How's 7:30? He nodded and gave me a shy grin. I managed to walk 2 steps before realizing there was one matter that needed to be resolved before tomorrow night.
"What do you eat?" I whispered, my face flushing.
"I'm omnivorous," Matthew said, his face brightening further into a smile that made my heart skip a beat.
7:30, then.
I turned away, laughing and shaking my head at his unhelpful answer. "Oh, one more thing," I said, turning back. "Let Miriam do her own work. I really can take care of myself."
"So she tells me," Matthew said, walking around to the driver's side of the car. "I'll consider it, but you'll find me in Duke Humphrey's tomorrow as usual."
He got into the car, and when I showed no sign of moving, he rolled down his window.
"I'm not leaving until you're out of my sight," he said, looking at me in disapproval.
"Vampires," I muttered, shaking my head at his old-fashioned ways.
Chapter 12.
Nothing in my culinary experience had taught me what to feed a vampire when he came for dinner. In the library, I spent most of the day on the internet looking for recipes that involved raw foods, my manuscripts forgotten on the desk. Matthew said he was omnivorous, but that couldn't be true. A vampire must be more likely to tolerate uncooked food if he was used to a diet of blood. But he was so civilized he would no doubt eat whatever I put in front of him. After undertaking extensive gastronomical research, I left the library at mid-afternoon. Matthew had held down Fortress Bishop by himself today, which must have pleased Miriam. There was no sign of Peter Knox or Gillian Chamberlain anywhere in Duke Humphreys, which made me happy. Even Matthew looked in good humor when I trotted down the aisle to return my manuscripts. Passing by the dome of the Radcliffe Camera, where the undergraduates read their assigned books, and the medieval walls of Jesus College, I went shopping along the aisles of Oxford's Covered Market. List in hand, I made my first stop at the butcher for fresh venison and rabbit, and then to the fishmonger for Scottish salmon.
Did vampires eat greens?
Thanks to my mobile, I was able to reach the zoology department and inquire about the feeding habits of wolves. They asked me what kind of wolves. I'd seen gray wolves on a long-ago field trip to the Boston Zoo, and it was Matthew's favorite color, so that was my answer. After rattling off a long list of tasty mammals and explaining that they were preferred foods, the bored voice on the other end told me that gray wolves also ate nuts, seeds, and berries. "But you shouldn't feed them," the voice warned. "They're not house pets." "Thanks for the advice," I said, trying not to giggle. The grocer apologetically sold me the last of the summer's black currants and some fragrant wild strawberries. A bag of chestnuts found its way into my expanding shopping bag, too. Then it was off to the wine store, where I found myself at the mercy of a viticultural evangelist who asked if the gentleman knew wine. That was enough to send me into a tailspin. The clerk seized upon my confusion to sell me what ended up being a remarkably few French and German bottles of wine for a king's ransom. He then tucked me into a cab to recover from the sticker shock during the drive back to college. In my rooms, I swept all the papers off a battered 18th-century table that served as both desk and dining room, and moved it closer to the fireplace. I set the table carefully, using the old porcelain and silver that was in my cupboards, along with heavy crystal glasses that had to be the final remainders of an Edwardian set once used in the senior common room. My loyal kitchen ladies had supplied me with stacks of crisp white linen, which were now draped over the table, folded next to the silver, and spread on the chipped wooden tray that would help me carry things the short distance from the kitchen. Once I started making dinner, it became clear that cooking for a vampire doesn't take much time. You don't actually cook much of anything. By 7 o'clock, the candles were lit, the food was ready except for what could be done only at the last minute, and all that was left to get ready was me. My wardrobe contained precious little that said, "Dinner with a Vampire." There was no way I was dining with Matthew in a suit or in the outfit I'd worn to meet the warden. The number of black trousers and leggings I owned was mind-boggling, all with different degrees of spandex, but most were splotched with tea, boat grease, or both. Finally, I found a pair of swishy black trousers that looked a bit like pajama bottoms, but with slightly more style.
They'd do.
Wearing nothing but a bra and the trousers, I ran into the bathroom and dragged a comb through my shoulder-length, straw-colored hair. Not only was it tied in knots at the end, it was daring me to make it behave by lifting up from my scalp with every touch of the comb. I briefly considered resorting to the curling iron, but chances were excellent I'd get only half my head done by the time Matthew arrived. He was going to be on time, I just knew it. While brushing my teeth, I decided the only thing to do about my hair was to pull it away from my face and twist it into a knot. This made my chin and nose look more pointed, but created the illusion of cheekbones and got my hair out of my eyes, which is where it gravitated these days. I pinned it back, and one piece immediately flopped forward. I sighed. My mother's face stared back at me from the mirror. I thought of how beautiful she'd looked when she sat down to dinner, and wondered what she'd done to make her pale eyebrows and lashes stand out the way they did, and why her wide mouth looked so different when she smiled at me or my father. The clock ruled out any idea of achieving a similar transformation cosmetically. I had only 3 minutes to find a shirt, or I was going to be greeting Matthew Claremont, distinguished professor of biochemistry and neuroscience, in my underwear. The wardrobe contained two possibilities, one black and one midnight blue. The midnight blue had the virtue of being clean, which was the determining factor in its favor. It also had a funny collar that stood up in the back and winged toward my face before descending into a V-shaped neckline. The arms were relatively snug and ended in long, stiff cuffs that flared out slightly and ended up somewhere around the middle of the back of my hand. I was sticking a pair of silver earrings through my ears when there was a knock at the door. My chest fluttered at the sound, as if this were a date. I squashed the thought immediately. When I pulled the door open, Matthew stood outside looking like the prince in a fairy tale, tall and straight. In a break with his usual habits, he wore unadulterated black, which only made him look more striking, and more a vampire. He waited patiently on the landing while I examined him. "Where are my manners? Please come in, Matthew. Will that do as a formal invitation to enter my house?" I had seen that on TV or read it in a book. His lips curved into a smile.
"Forget most of what you think you know about vampires, Diana. This is just normal politeness. I'm not being held back by a mystical barrier standing between me and a fair maiden."
Matthew had to stoop slightly to make it through the doorframe. He cradled a bottle of wine and carried some white roses.
"For you," he said, giving me an approving look and handing me the flowers. "Is there somewhere I can put this until dessert?" He glanced down at the bottle.
"Thank you, I love roses. How about the windowsill?" I suggested, before heading to the kitchen to look for a vase.
My other vase had turned out to be a decanter, according to the senior common room's wine steward, who had come to my rooms a few hours earlier to point it out to me when I expressed doubt that I had such an item.
"Perfect," Matthew replied. When I returned with the flowers, he was drifting around the room looking at the engravings. "You know, these really aren't too bad," he said, as I set the vase on a scarred Napoleonic-era chest of drawers. "Mostly hunting scenes, I'm afraid."
"That had not escaped my attention," Matthew said, his mouth curved in amusement. I flushed with embarrassment.
"Are you hungry?"
I had completely forgotten the obligatory nibbles and drinks you were supposed to serve before dinner. "I could eat," the vampire said with a grin.
Safely back in the kitchen, I pulled two plates out of the refrigerator. The first course was smoked salmon with fresh dill sprinkled on top, and a small pile of capers and gherkins arranged artistically on the side, where they could be construed as garnish if vampires didn't eat greens. When I returned with the food, Matthew was waiting by the chair that was farthest from the kitchen. The wine was waiting in a high-sided silver coaster I'd been using to hold change, but which the same helpful member of the senior common room staff had explained was actually intended to hold wine. Matthew sat down while I extracted the cork from a bottle of German Riesling. I poured two glasses without spilling a drop and joined him. My dinner guest was lost in concentration, holding the Riesling in front of his long, aquiline nose. I waited for him to finish whatever he was doing,
wondering how many sensory receptors vampires had in their noses as opposed to dogs. I really didn't know the first thing about vampires.
"Very nice," he finally said, opening his eyes and smiling at me.
"I'm not responsible for the wine," I said quickly, snapping my napkin onto my lap. "The man at the wine store picked everything out, so if it's no good, it's not my fault."
"Very nice," he said again. "And the salmon looks wonderful."
Matthew picked up his knife and fork and speared a piece of fish. Watching him from under my lashes to see if he could actually eat it, I piled a bit of pickle, a caper, and some salmon on the back of my own fork.
"You don't eat like an American," he commented after he'd taken a sip of wine.
"No," I said, looking at the fork in my left hand and the knife in my right. "I expect I've spent too much time in England."
"Can you really eat this?" I blurted, unable to stand it anymore.
He laughed.
"Yes, I happen to like smoked salmon."
"But you don't eat everything," I insisted, turning my attention back to my plate.
"No," he admitted, "but I can manage a few bites of most food. It doesn't taste like much to me, though, unless it's raw."
"That's odd. Considering that vampires have such perfect senses, I'd think that all food would taste wonderful." My salmon tasted as clean as fresh, cold water. He picked up his wine glass and looked into the pale, golden liquid.
"Wine tastes wonderful. Food tastes wrong to a vampire once it's been cooked to death."
I reviewed the menu with enormous relief.
"If food doesn't taste good, why do you keep inviting me out to eat?" I asked.
Matthew's eyes flickered over my cheeks, my eyes, and lingered on my mouth.
"It's easier to be around you when you're eating. The smell of cooked food nauseates me."
I blinked at him, still confused.
"As long as I'm nauseated, I'm not hungry," Matthew said, his voice exasperated.
"Oh!"
The pieces clicked together. I already knew he liked the way I smelled. Apparently, that made him hungry.
"Oh." I flushed.
"I thought you knew that about vampires," he said more gently, "and that's why you invited me for dinner."
I shook my head, tucking another bundle of salmon together. "I probably know less about vampires than most humans do, and the little my Aunt Sarah taught me has to be treated as highly suspect, given her prejudices. She was quite clear, for instance, on your diet. She said vampires will consume only blood because it's all you need to survive. But that isn't true, is it?"
Matthew's eyes narrowed, and his tone was suddenly frosty.
"No. You need water to survive. Is that all you drink?"
"Should I not be talking about this?"
My questions were making him angry. Nervously, I wrapped my legs around the base of the chair and realized I'd never put on any shoes. I was entertaining in bare feet.
"It can't help being curious, I suppose," Matthew replied, after considering my question for a long moment. "I drink wine and can eat food, preferably uncooked food, or food that's cold so that it doesn't smell."
"But the food and wine don't nourish you," I guessed. "You feed on blood. All kinds of blood." He flinched.
"And you don't have to wait outside until I invite you into my house. What else do I have wrong about vampires?"
Matthew's face adopted an expression of long-suffering patience. He sat back in his chair, taking the wine glass with him. I stood up slightly and reached across the table to pour him some more. If I was going to ply him with questions, I could at least ply him with wine, too. Leaning over the candles, I almost set my shirt on fire. Matthew grabbed the wine bottle.
"Why don't I do that?" he suggested.
He poured himself some more and topped up my glass as well before he answered.
"Most of what you know about me, about vampires, was dreamed up by humans. These legends made it possible for humans to live around us. Creatures frightened them, and I'm not talking solely about vampires.
Black hats, bats, brooms. It was the unholy trinity of witchcraft lore, which burst into spectacular, ridiculous life every year on Halloween."
"Exactly,"
Matthew nodded. "Somewhere in each of these stories there's a nugget of truth, something that frightened humans and helped them deny we were real. The strongest distinguishing characteristic of humans is their power of denial. I have strength and long life, you have supernatural abilities,
Demons have awe-inspiring creativity. Humans can convince themselves up is down and black is white. It's their special gift.
What's the truth in this?